Hi everyone, welcome to PA Talks. In this episode, we are thrilled to host a visionary from the world of architecture. He's Iman Ansari. He is the co-founder of architectural practice called Anonymous and also associate professor of architecture, Knowlton School at the State University of Ohio. We will dive into some of Iman's recent projects and also talk about current emerging technologies in architecture. Before we dive into the episode, let's highlight Pacademy, an architectural educational platform dedicated to parametric design and computational tools in architecture. In collaboration with top architects and designers, we have covered a vast array of topics in this domain. Join our live workshops and explore the cutting-edge intersection of design, technology, and architecture. Now let's get into the discussion with Iman Ansari. Okay, thank you so much, Iman, for joining our office for this interview. I've been looking forward to have this conversation with you. At PA Talks, you have been bringing so many of pioneering architects and forward thinkers in our platform, and they have been sharing their ideas, they have been sharing their experiences, how they are doing it, why they are doing it, and it's been a great source of information for the aspiring architects who want to learn your people's story, architects' story. So we're so excited to have you here. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Hamid. I'm excited to be here and I look forward to this.
Thank you so much. For those people who have not yet heard about Iman Ansari, could you please introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Iman Ansari. I'm an architect currently based mostly in the US, obviously in both in California and Ohio. We also have done projects and are working in New York and Texas as well. I'm also an educator. I teach split my time between academia and practice.
Great, awesome. So what are you focused on these days? Which one is taking much of your time, practice or academia?
Well, it's a difficult question. It's I would say splitting time between the two is a challenge. Usually during the year, during the school year, we're more occupied and busy with teaching and research. And when the school slows down in the summer and during the winter breaks, we shift gear to practice. So I would say right now, given we're in the middle of the semester, I would say mostly teaching, research, writing, and less practice. We pick that up usually around April, and some of the projects, most of the work we do, we invest in the summer, and then we continue during the year in terms of overseeing the work. If it's in construction or if it's developing, we kind of slow down but continue it during the year.
Mm-hmm. What do you do exactly at Anonymous? Like, what are your generally focused on, and what is your principles that you try to portray out the Anonymous is doing this kind of work? What is exactly that you set up as the principles of your practice?
So I became interested in architecture because I, as a young person, I was interested in architecture as a field that combines art and science, but something that creates interactions, meaningful, sometimes mysterious interactions between bodies and environments. So when we started Anonymous, I would say about 10, 11 years ago, we were interested in those issues, but we were also really interested in the idea of technology and architecture. So the type of work we do, I would say, is we do various scales. We do work from furniture design to interiors to architecture, buildings, and even urban design projects. But our main focus is the relationship between bodies, buildings, and how technology and architecture can mediate and manage and organize that relationship. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we explore, not just through our use of tools through design, through representation, but also how those tools and technologies inform the interactions, movements, and the relationships that occur in the space architecturally. So that part of it is building technology in general. Other aspects of it is kind of appropriating certain technologies that were not traditionally part of architects' tool set. They were not traditionally part of buildings, but beginning to appropriate them into architecture. Like the office chairs we're both sitting on is a good example of that.
Yeah, talking about the chairs, you recently did a good project that I really like about it. It's the gravity chair.
Zero gravity.
It's a circle chair that it can move, it can go around, it has different stages, that steps that you can sit on or use your laptop with, or have some coffee on it. So would you like to talk about it?
Yeah, it's actually one of the, I would say, earlier projects we did. So we started our office in New York. My partner and I were both at the time in New York. And at that time, we were doing really large scale. I think we did 2 or 3 projects, urban design proposals. And then within about 2 years, we moved to Los Angeles, to California. And moving to California kind of not only transformed us as individuals and kind of, but also really changed our practice as well. We were really inspired by the culture in LA. We were inspired by the work of LA architects, especially the LA school. People like Tom Main, Craig Hodges, Frank Gehry, also the newer generations, Neil Denari, Greg Lynn, and many others who we also got a chance to work with, who were teaching with them at UCLA. And the type of projects we started doing also changed. So the project you're mentioning, we began a collaboration with UCLA City Lab and worked on kind of one project that had 2 components for NASA JPL. So JPL, as you may know, is the kind of engineering component of NASA. They design the rovers and the machines that, like the Martian rovers that were sent to Mars. And we were asked to offer proposals for the redesign of JPL's offices in Pasadena, California. So one component of it was the interior, which we looked at their office chair, and the problem with the office chairs. The office chair is actually interesting because the very first office chair was Charles Darwin's, who manually attached the wheels to his normal chair so he could move around his office while he was working with different specimens and he was looking at his books and all that. So, and since then, office chairs really haven't changed much. There's still chairs on wheels, right? So, and because they're designed the way they are, then the floor has to be flat, it has to be certain material, you can't have thick carpets because you can't move your chair, and the desk has to be certain height. So we realized that a lot of the problems, the kind of mundane or generic appearance of a lot of offices is not the fault of architecture, it's the fault of the office chair. So we can't really rethink it without redesigning the office chair. So what we did is we were inspired by JPL's rovers. So we decided to design an office rover, which we called, in the spirit of spirit opportunity, we called this productivity. And with that, because it had rover wheels, you could have the office could have any terrain, and it kind of liberated us to completely transform the interior. The second component of that was they asked for a kind of a workspace where they for basically outdoor workspace, so people could in their campus, they could work outside, they could have a focus space, they could collaborate, you know. And this is where zero gravity came in. So we were interested in the idea, the use of tubular steel furniture, especially the modernist architects. Many of them used tubular steel, Marcel Breuer, Mies van der Rohe, Le Corbusier, others. But we were also interested in the use of tubular steel in the medical industry. Like the first collapsible wheelchair was made of tubular steel because it could they could design a strong frame, but they could also fold it. And for us, that was interesting. It was so the chair was really inspired by those modernist chairs. Including the first collapsible wheelchair by Everest and Jennings. And we basically decided to place all of them around the circle, around the loop. And
that's where Sigma comes from.
The what?
That's where the circle idea to come from?
Yeah, because first we wanted them to be able to move it anywhere. So we were like, how do you move something? So we made it, we decided it has to be a big wheel. And then we decided that if we place all of these profiles of the chairs around the wheel, then you could choose any of the chairs you want by just turning the wheel. In a way, you get four chairs in one.
Four different type of chairs in one chair.
Yeah. So that was the start. But then when we placed them, then we realized there are all these spaces between the chairs that were not meant to be used to sit or lean, but they create these new postures. So in some ways you have unlimited number of postures and seating positions. You could sit on one of those sort of prescripted chairs, Mies, Le Corbusier, Marcel Breuer, the wheelchair, but you could also kind of invent your own and find your own comfort zone within that frame. So that's where basically where the idea came from and how it was developed.
It looks interesting, like very innovative, and it seems like it should be, it fits inside a tech company's office or a campus or somewhere.
But you know, the key thing for us, because this is why zero gravity, for me personally, is probably one of the most important projects we did. Because we always wanted to kind of present architecture as something that is deeply tied to the human body, that it cannot exist and it cannot be conceived without establishing a relationship with the body. And zero gravity was important because, and the reason it's called zero gravity is because the chair has no orientation or position. If you leave it outside, it can keep rolling and moving. And it only finds balance with a human body inside. So it's only complete with a human body inside. And that way, for us, it tied the idea of architecture as a large piece of furniture or a microenvironment to the human body and the idea of creating this balance and this idea of becoming whole together in one place. So that's kind of why for us it was really important too.
Are there any other projects like this coming?
Well, we actually recently did a project also in collaboration with UCLA Study Lab for UCLA. It's called Bean, and it was dealing with the problem of housing insecurity. So in a lot of big cities in the US, especially in a place like Los Angeles, many students live very far from campus. And because of traffic and distance, they cannot go home and come back So what happens is a lot of them decide, end up sleeping in their cars on camp or stay on campus just because they can't go back home and get back on time. So there's this housing issue and places around campus are too expensive. There's not enough housing. So UCLA came up with the idea of what they called Bruin Hub, which is pretty amazing, where they decided to set up a space with a series of pods that students can rest, study, sometimes wait out traffic before going home, or in the middle of the day if somebody needs just, you know, there's no place for anyone to go and take a nap or go and focus and study, relax, or have some privacy, really. So we work with City Lab to develop that. And the key component of that is the bean, which is a individual pod, I would say even smaller than zero gravity, which is also shaped like a bean. And you have this individual pods that are easily fabricated, relatively.
But it's not holding these chairs.
It has wheels, but it's not meant to be as mobile as zero gravity. You could still move it around in the room, but you have also inside, you have a place to plug in, charge your phone, you have a moving screen. If you need privacy, you can sit and work, you can turn the little pillow or a thing and literally sleep. So it's kind of this little personal space for students to just rest, study, relax, or just sometimes just hang out.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. You also worked with, you proposed a project for Hyperloop.
Yeah, Hyperloop was very exciting, but also challenging. And it happened exactly right around the time we moved to LA. Like within the first 2 years, we were working with NASA JPL, and we started working with Hyperloop as their design partner. Hyperloop, we were particularly working, there are two companies have been developing Hyperloop. So we were working with one of them, Hyperloop Transportation Technologies. And we were really excited about it because exactly there's no precedent for it. Like if you get hired to design a train station or an airport, you have precedence, you have a set of standards already established. As an architect, you know how to go about it. You know,
everything is written for it.
Yeah, there are codes, standards, protocols already defined. And because of that, those established building types, right? So building types have already all those kind of the standardized components established within them. With Hyperloop, there was no precedent. So we had to kind of write the manual, write the standards from scratch, and we had to figure out what's the role of architecture within this new transportation system. So we worked with them. We started initially working with them designing their showroom in LA. We then helped them design the interior of the capsules. We worked with them to design the pylons, the kind of these forms of urban infrastructure that carry the tubes within cities and rural areas. But the key component was the design of the station or the terminal. And that took us a lot of kind of time and discussions and working closely with the team at Hyperloop and the engineers to figure out like what does this hub, we call it mobility hub, looks like. And you know, just to give you an example of it, with Hyperloop, because of the speed, we had to account for a movement of 30,000 people within a day in the station, if it is to say work in a city like Los Angeles. and to manage the movement and flow of not just the capsules coming into the station, unloading, reloading, and leaving, but also how to move the people, the yeah. huge crowds, and move them as efficiently as possible through the space. But I would say, as architects, what beyond kind of issues of efficiency and engineering and mechanical components, what we really were interested in was to turn this hub into a destination, really in a true sense of the word. So it's not just the place you go to travel, but to kind of turn it into a really vibrant, active public space. It sort of put interesting programs there that people could benefit from, so that they don't have to, sometimes they don't really need to travel. They could just come there for a meeting, come there to do shopping, come there to play, come there to watch a movie, and integrating it with transportation within the city.
Yeah, right. Like as technology moves forward, new kind of spaces or architecture is needed, of course, and the Hyperloop station, as after that time, even we saw other companies also propose ideas about stations in Europe, in Abu Dhabi, Dubai, and this is going to be one of the challenges of how to emerge new standards for these kind of spaces inside our cities, and what would be the relations, what would be the interactions of the people. It's not a random metro station. It's mm-hmm. just a hub. It's like a terminal which connected with higher speed machines, let's say. Yeah, definitely it requires so many hours of technology and so many hours of figuring out the things. And I was amazed by your project, actually. And yeah, quite creative enough. And you're also working on the North Star Medical Campus. Do you want to talk about it as well?
Yeah, so this is a project we actually started right around the time we last met started 2018, but it really picked up 2019, and it's still ongoing. This is a medical campus, as we like to call it, in North Richland Hills in Texas, which is a suburb of Fort Worth, so Dallas and Fort Worth area. There are three buildings, and the first building was just completed a few months ago, and we're now starting construction on the second and the third building. So that's a project where I would say it's actually our first ground up built project, and so we're really excited about it. And but you know, it was like most early projects, there were a lot of limitations. Our budget, I would say, was not very generous, so we had to work with we had to try to do a lot with very little time, very little resources, consultants.
As all projects, actually.
As all projects. I mean, not all projects. Some architects get big budget projects, so they can do a lot. So I would say what we try to do, I mean, in every project, we really try to, rather than trying to do everything, we pick on one thing and try to do it or rethink it well. And hopefully reinvent that thing. And so in this project, we were really interested in the idea of movement, of how an office works, really, not like how it looks like or where the rooms are, but really how do people patients, doctors, nurses, staff move in the office, because the movement and flow of doctors, patients, and staff in a medical office is actually really complex, and they usually work like clockwork. So patients come in, they check in, they wait, then a nurse comes, picks them up, takes them to a room, the nurse goes, calls the doctor goes, visits the room, then the doctor goes back, the nurse checks, talks to the patients, then the patient goes, they check out, they pay.
And then there's
a pattern, and it keeps repeating. So you can't, if you look at a lot of medical spaces, they really have over the years become the layout and the way they're designed, they're really designed based on that model of that efficient circulation pattern. And when we were first approached by the project, the client told us, I have three priorities. Number one, circulation efficiency. Number two, circulation efficiency. And number three, circulation efficiency. So we realized that this is really important. And as an example, he was telling us, if my gloves are moved 2 inches, I would spend half a second more to grab them. If you add that half a second to the 50 patients I see every day, that's this many minutes that I lose. And I see less patients, I make less money, the patients are less happy. And so that's the kind of importance of this efficiency. So
you mentioned you run a couple of simulations, or many of them. Can you also elaborate a little bit more on that?
So how do you design for that? You know, the tools we have, CAD, Rhino, Revit, you know, none of them can actually test the stuff. So in the past, like in the 19th century or early 20th century, architects would build mock-ups or do experiments on physical space and test it. But at the scale of a building, you know, unless you build a mock-up one-to-one scale and have doctors, patients, and nurses kind of moving the space and observe them, there's no way to test it, at least till now. So then we learned about these simulation tools. So they're now there's actually more, but at the time we started, we were using two simulation software, Pedestrian Dynamic and AnyLogic. And what these tools do is they were designed originally to simulate the movement of crowds, especially in large buildings or spaces like airports, train stations, stadia.
So it simulates the human interaction with the environment, or
it simulates, you know, it actually originally,
or it simulates objects as well, like,
well,
what is it
closest? It simulates how humans, originally it was developed as a way to simulate the movement of the flock of birds, or a school of fish. But what they do is you set up the space in a 3D model, and then you say, I have 200 people coming in, or let's say in a stadium. You have a model of the stadium with everyone seated in their seat, the game finishes, and then you say, now everybody's leaving. So it simulates how people get up, and how they move through the exits, where they go, how long it takes, how much traffic there's gonna be, if it's overcrowded, people stop, and then it piles up, right? So typically, at least in the way it's been used, it's the behavior of those human agents in the computer model is just they all do the same thing. Like a crowd in a stadium, that they all have to exit. So they all move, or in a train station, you just come into the thing or you leave. We wanted to use the software, but we had very specific behavior, because the way a doctor moves in a medical office, or a patient or a nurse, is not the same. So we had to go and reprogram the behavior of and establish different agents, so and set up the pattern of their movement and the fact that they have to meet and move, and so that's a much more complex layer of interaction simulation. So it took us at the beginning when we started, the softwares were not very developed, they were not very user friendly. So it took us, it was a painful process
to modify
and recode it. And
I mean, was it a kind of open source thing or?
Well, it kind of, you know, no, the software does allow you to define behavior, but I don't think they, when they designed it, they expected someone to design the behavior of a doctor or a nurse. Yeah. So the behaviors are usually very simple behaviors. You know, like go from this room to that room, but not like go from this room to that room, pick up one person, walk with them, go back to this room, right? So yeah, we had to kind of figure that out and resolve it. But once we did, then we had a working model. Like we kind of had that sort of scripted version, digital version of it. And what we decided to do, we were like, we want, rather than using the tool to, rather than designing a space and then using the tool to just test it, just validate our theories, we want to use it as a design tool. So in order to do that, we just laid out and placed the main spaces in a computer model, and then we ran the simulation. And then it gives you an analysis that says, these are the bottlenecks, this is traffic, these are the spaces mostly used, these other spaces not used. So you could begin to see how it works. Then we looked at that, we're like, okay, there's too much traffic here, this is too far, and then we moved the stuff around and then we ran it again. So we kept doing it, and every time we get the results, we would go and modify and move the spaces in the plan. So essentially the floor plan developed through this iterative simulation process, which not only allowed us to kind of test those assumptions, but also to use the tool as no longer as just an experimentation tool, but really as a design tool. And so that we could actually know by some degree of scientific certainty that how the space would be used and whether it works or not. So
yeah, actually this is a good point that you mentioned, and I think this is the direction that computational design and parametric design is headed, to use the power of computation to simulate the human behavior inside a space rather than designing the walls or like the shape of the or the geometry, but designing the interaction, designing the amount of crowd, designing the efficiency in terms of the time, efficiency in terms of using the maximum amount of space. I think, yeah, computational design is moving towards that. The first years that we had it was just the aesthetical aspects of the computation and parametric design. But nowadays, it's much more deeper. It's much more practical. It's much more efficiency and heading into a right direction, I think.
Yeah,
it's also involving the geometrical and aesthetical stuff. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think obviously, I mean, as architects, we love how things work, but we also love how they look.
Yeah.
So you can't separate the two. You know, just like in nature, or you know, form and function are always tied. You know, I think the problem is on the when we focus too much on one thing and forget the other, whether it's focus on form and disregarding how that form, what type of function and use that form implies, or on the other hand, if we focus too much on function and efficiency, we and disregard the formal, but also I would say the cultural and the the meaningful symbolic qualities of architecture as well, material qualities as well. I think simulation, I am really excited about computation and all of this, but more in a way how they allow us to do things that we couldn't do in the past. I think in the past, as an example, like when I'm now writing, working on a book on the history and design and construction of the Johns Hopkins Hospital. And there was a time, because they didn't have tools to test it, they would build, like the Hopkins Hospital was built as an architectural laboratory. So each building was designed differently, or the ones that were same with a different heating and ventilation. So they could test how people would behave and how they would feel in each building, so they could arrive at the best solution. So and that's the only example that you actually had to build the thing. And now we don't have to do that. We can do it with no cost of construction, no cost to any living human being. We could use simulation to do all of that and to actually see the impacts of what we design in a digital environment and design through that before it's building physical in the physical realm. And you know, a lot of companies are developing their own simulation tools already and appropriating the technology to their specific use. A lot of architecture firms now are using simulation tools and they're offering services. But I think it's not yet, you know, other than a few people using it in their teaching, in their design studios and schools, it's not typically how we're taught to design.
Yeah.
You know, we're taught to draw floor plans and diagrams and draw arrows and show.
I think in the school, we're so manual still in architecture education,
mm-hmm.
in schools. We're still so manual.
Mm-hmm.
And this is affecting somehow the students, the future of them, their absorption to the practice, to completely adapt with the new tools and technologies. It takes a lot of time, but yeah, what are your points on the new tools that are emerging? Like, I don't know if you have used them or not. Like Midjourney, DALL-E, ChatGPT, probably you have tested, of course.
Yeah, of course. I'm very interested in where that's going. You know, to respond to your comments about education, I think we're living in a time where tools and technologies and techniques that emerge from them, they're developing so fast that it's hard to keep up, whether indeed. Both in academia, the academy, but also in practice as well. Because by the time you establish an educational model around it, the tool is outdated and we have to move on. So yeah, there is a little bit of that, that the academy is to some degree lagging. Not always, by the way, but let's say generally speaking. But it's not just just teaching, let's say, students, teaching them tools and teaching them how to use the tools or how to come up with inventive ways to use the tools. It's also the way we deliver projects. Right? If you think about, I tell my students always, like, if you think about the way you walk around every architecture school, students still do drawings, usually plans and sections and maybe some views. They print it on paper, pin it up on the wall, and then they have a physical model, right? And that's how the projects are presented, right? And they stand and talk. If you compare that to, I'm not even gonna go say the Beaux-Arts, but if you compare that, I don't think that has changed essentially as a model since the Renaissance, right? Mm-hmm. like it's the same thing. It's relying on forms of two-dimensional inscriptions on paper, drawings and text, and a physical model. And both are static. Both are not able to show movement. They're not able to show time. They're not able to show, to some extent, even scale in a way that we could. So I think it's not just the tools and teaching them, but also how projects are presented that need to be reevaluated and rethought. Now about AI and Midjourney and DALL-E, you know, when I haven't personally used DALL-E, but when Midjourney became available and I began using it, one of the first things I did, I put in, because as you well know, it translates text into image, right? So it's a text to image. I put in a simple white cube because I know the tool can do amazing things, but I wanted to know how intelligent the artificial intelligence is. And it did so many iterations and they all look beautiful, but none of them were either simple because they all had aggregate, you know, they looked complex without needing to be complex. So they weren't really simple because a lot of them had multiple cubes within one cube, even though I wrote cube. They weren't simple. They weren't always white. They were some milky white, yellow, little brownish, almost like painted on canvas because it assumed like I want a painting or a drawing, right? And if you look, none of them were cubes because the heights and the widths of the sides were always different. So at the end, I got a series of images that were neither simple nor white nor a cube.
Right.
Now, since then, Midjourney has corrected those.
Yeah. So it's been developed a lot. Like the first models, it was very basic. Like now I typed what you said, simple white cube.
Yeah.
This is what it pops up.
Okay.
That's this good. Is really simple white cube.
Yeah. Yeah. So now I think it's. So they are improving it, right?
But the version 4 is very much ahead of like the first models that they released a couple of months ago. Like it's very advanced.
Yeah. And I think they're doing a fantastic job. But generally what I think is, and let's not forget, this is gonna revolutionize the way we represent projects.
Exactly.
I think to ignore that, it's just you can't ignore that. I mean, in the past, just a few years ago, you would have to hire a visualization company and pay, which we've done in the past, pay a couple of $1,000 to get an image. And now you could do it within seconds.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So is it gonna impact architecture? Is it gonna replace architects? I would say no, but it is gonna transform the industry and it is gonna transform a lot of the visualization parts, a lot of the labor and cost, time that used to go into visualizing things, especially if you wanna talk to clients, communicate your ideas, all that. But I think it's important to differentiate between because it's called artificial intelligence. It's important to differentiate between intelligence and creativity. And this is something that not in architecture, in other fields, they're dealing with it too. People, you know, are like now with ChatGPT, they're testing how the machine can write like Shakespeare and how well it can write like certain like big figures in art, in literature, and it can do a good job. But what the machine can do, it can only use its available database, which for now it's just the stuff online.
Yes,
and
even
predict.
Not the updated data. It was probably before 2022. It's written there that the yeah. database is old. Like, you can't find today's news on ChatGPT or...
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but still, the stuff online is limited. But the key is it uses a database, but it can only recombine and represent those. And, you know, it cannot come up with its own. Like, you can do a great job imitating Shakespeare, but it cannot become a new Shakespeare and come up with a new... I mean, maybe in the future it can, but the way it works as a model that uses a database and tries to predict patterns and predict what you want, inevitably it cannot generate new things. It cannot create new things. It can only recombine and represent it. If you look at the images, beautiful images that Midjourney DALL-E produces, it's always fragments and ideas of existing artists, architects, visualizations, right? So there's a whole issue about
the authorship.
Authorship there as well,
yeah.
Right? It only uses their ideas to generate new ones. Now, we can have a conversation about whether what we define as creativity, because you could say, you know, to be creative, we are always influenced by
yeah.
stuff we see, and we always use that and create new things. Maybe to some extent that's true, there's always influence, but I also think that
if you would give like percentage, what do you think? I believe like 95 or maybe not more than 90% of our creativity is driven by the inspirations that we had from before. Maybe 5 or 10% we add creativity, and then it becomes something new.
Mm-hmm. Maybe
we always inspire from people who did things before us.
Yeah, there's no question. There's no question about that. And I think you know, we could argue whether, if it comes to say visual production, how limited that is. We are limited with a limited number of materials, colors, forms. So you can't just come up with, ultimately whatever you come up with in some form or another is coming from existing material palettes, yeah. colors, forms in the app world, right? But I think the key question is then, what is architecture? If architecture is about producing images, and by the way, these are all 2D, so the machine, at least for now, cannot generate 3D. Will it do it? Yeah, I'm pretty sure within a few months it will start generating 3D as well. But the challenge with that is we have a ton of images online, but if you look at the database for architects, like if this is to be implemented in architecture, and we want the machine not to design a building. Let's say we're designing a medical office, right? And instead of spending time doing research and looking at floor plans and all that, we want the machine to survey them and come up with a generic working model. So at least we have a place to start and we know how it works. I think it can do it, right? But in order to do that, you need a database of 3D models of buildings. That database, I would say, doesn't exist. Like, if you look at all...
Not
like,
now.
Well, not now, yeah. But to do that, we need to then first build a database for... Because architecture is more than just the visual appearance of the buildings or interiors. And if we want the machine to tell us a little bit about how buildings are put together, how spaces relate to each other, what's the size of the things, what's the relationship between them, where do you get in, where do you get out, right? Then that information has to be in 3D. If you go on Google or SketchUp Warehouse, the only 3D models you can find is probably Frankfurt Wright's Falling Water and Le Corbusier's, you know, Villa Savoie, right? And so there's two parts. One is the 3D fonts, which a lot of offices have, but that they haven't yet shared it. So we have to go to architects' offices and ask for the 3D models of buildings, right?
Yeah, that's I think the issue. I think architecture companies, because the database is not available for everyone, we are not in that stage to generate 3D models, or because as you mentioned, there are so many relationships, there are so many considerations in designing process that without having database, we can't guess about them, and we can't train the algorithm to have predictions or generating some stuff about it. Because each architecture office company until now, the projects that they have built, they have done, it was all confidential. Mm-hmm. And there, it's not out there. So we can have a broader database of, well, let's say, 10,000 architecture offices around the world who have worked on, for example, hospitals or a medical center or a cinema or a cultural center. We don't have that database, so we lack it. Mm-hmm. Recently, I have been hearing some news about some architecture companies joining forces to create some kind of a mutual database as a shared technology between themselves. Don't know about the details of it and don't know about all the companies, just heard a couple of names. But if such a things happen, it's really a huge help, yeah. Huge help for professionals. Like it's a step forward. Like we won't be doing architecture if we have such a thing as we did before.
I think, yeah, I agree. I think we need that database before we, otherwise all we would do, keep doing is yes. to play with images and 2D images, which is nice, you know, but it's not gonna get us architecture. It's gonna get us images. Yeah. But you know, and this is a challenge. It's not just with AI. I mean, that's why in Brooklyn, a few years ago, did a show at the CCA called The Archaeology of the Digital. I mean, since architects in the late 80s and throughout 90s shifted to digital tools and technologies, I mean, we don't have the archive of all the, in the past, you had series of trees, sketches and paper drawings and all that. So it was easy to have an archive of, say, Cedric Price's work, you know, and have it all in one place. Now, if you want to archive, and this, which is what he was doing, and Frank Gehry's work or some of the architects or Zaha's office, right? The drawings alone are not enough, because the drawings are just the stuff that were handed to the contractors, the drawing set. Like where the 3D models and all the digital files that went along with it. And not only that, is that the computers and the softwares are changing so fast. In order to archive it, you also need those machines and the software to house that data. Right? But I would say, to go back to the conversation about AI, I think if you have the 3D model and you have all the information of a digital 3D model, that would be a huge help. But there's another factor to that too. If you work in any office, you know, there's some knowledge and expertise that is not yet part of any manual, any textbook. It doesn't show up in the drawings. And like if you're working in an office, say a junior architect is working in an office and they're designing a, say, skyscraper, right? The moment they start drawing curtain wall, they're gonna be taught like, hey, there's a certain set of rules. You can't do a curtain wall like this. Your, you know, the mullions have to be spaced this far. So that person will have to, at some point, sit with a senior architect, and the senior architect would redline the drawings and say the reason we placed them this far is, for instance, the class manufacturer, or the fact that the panels will come in this size because it doesn't fit the truck, or it doesn't, they cannot fit it in an elevator, or, yeah. Right? So that knowledge and expertise is not even in The office is, it's not even in the office's hard drive, like the 3D models, it's in the architect's head, right? And if we want AI to be fully intelligent and to design us at least thoughtful working buildings, you know, we also need to find a way to transfer that knowledge, that expertise to the machine as well. And there are softwares that I think are beginning to do that. I think the whole BIM industry and Revit, they're beginning to integrate some of that knowledge, but there's another layer to that that comes from experience, from and I think it's only in their heads, and we have to find ways to kind of extract it.
Exactly.
I remember I was reading an article in 2013, an article was published about the jobs that will be replaced by 2013 in US, 2030 in US, so 7 years from now, which might not be true completely, but they have been analyzed all the professions, 700, almost 700 professions, and they gave a computerization factor for each profession. Like this computerization factor, according to 100% to 0%, if it is high enough, it's gonna be replaced by AI or a computer model or anything automation stuff. Or if not, if it is close to 0 or 1, it's a very tough job. It requires very creativity. And the top of the list was cashiers, the servants, the easy jobs that require less talent to do. And the middle was around architecture and engineering drafting was around 47%, but architectural design was around 5%. The toughest job was archaeology, that required so many information and talent and creativity to guess, to have these predictions of, okay, this is the history, connect so many of information together to have this kind of prediction, okay, there's something in here. And I was just excited to when I read the archaeologists and architects 5%. Like, it might not be true 100%, like not 2030, maybe 2015, maybe 2016, not even 5%, maybe 10%, but it's also shows the study is based on analytics, and they were from a very good university in US. I don't remember the name actually. I'll just add in the video and the description so people can check out. And this is really interesting that the design part needs so many experience that is not written in the books, that is not written in the hard drive, it's not even taught in the school. You gain it with experience.
Yeah,
to your point.
No, that's, I completely agree. That's why I would say, you can never say never, right? But I see it would be a lot harder to substitute an architect with a machine. As an example, and what is AI good for? I think right now, for instance, in law, all the legal cases, that's how law operates, especially in a country like US. You have precedent of all the legal cases and the rulings and all of that that establishes the database for a lawyer. So a lawyer, a big part of a lawyer's job is to go and access that information, process it, find similar cases, and to then see, okay, this is how we should go about it. So that's something that the AI will be able to do within seconds, right? So the idea of processing large amount of data and being able to find patterns and kind of tie it together. Same with a big part of, say, a medical doctor. That's why WebMD became a thing, right? Because a lot of it is dealing with data, looking at symptoms, looking at cases, looking at database of medicine and treatments and finding correlations and looking at symptoms and being able to do it. Now, I think those are the type of things. I'm not saying it's an AI would replace a lawyer or a doctor, because you still have to physically examine and see and notice and talk and observe, get certain information that and make certain judgments that is not always available through data, through quantitative measures, right? So there's qualitative factors too. Same with the lawyer, right? But I would see bigger chunks of their work to be benefiting from AI than say architects. Architects, again, I would say all the research part, all the testing, all the sketching visualizations would be greatly benefiting from that. But the things we do is just too complicated, at least now, as the way it is now. And even the way we work, if you go to every architect's office, they work differently. So it's the method, the design methodology, delivery is also so different from office to office, from architect to office.
Exactly. There's not just one recipe of designing process. Each office has different set of rules, different set of approach, different set of tools. Mm-hmm. And it makes it very hard and tough to predict and collect in one set of role that you can say, okay, architects work with this, like this.
No, that's exactly what the machine does. It has an amazing ability to predict.
Yeah.
If you go to a doctor, the way, the method they use, you go to any doctor, it's usually within the same country, they follow the same method, right? They extract data, they examine the patient, they write it down in files, and then they process it and offer treatment, right? So the method is the same as not. I mean, yeah, there are some who do more traditional, but typically most professionals within that field follow the same method. I mean, architects, I would say it's hard to find two that follow the same method, right? So, and that's something that becomes very hard for the machine to learn and to predict.
Yeah, that's true. Like in design process, a lot, human intuition is so much involved, mm-hmm. rather than just following some prescript method.
And that's what makes architecture great. That's why we also love architecture, because we look at different people who every day rethink and reinvent not just objects and buildings and spaces, but they reinvent the practice of architecture, the way we work, the tools we use, or the how we misuse certain things and reappropriate it. So, and to me, that the whole thing, you know, from it's not like the product, the building as a product, but the process of producing it,
yes.
is part of quote unquote architecture.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm hoping AI would help us make it more interesting, more different,
more innovative, rather than standardizing it and saying, no, from now on, we will just design the way this architect designs. Mm-hmm.
No, that's completely true. And one thing that you mentioned, and I totally agree with that, is as we move forward, we are reinventing our profession. Nobody, if you ask what is architecture, ask 100 of them, they will all answer something different. What is architecture? What is architecture? Someone says form follows function, someone says this, someone says that. So it's very, very, there are variety of directions that architects are looking, and it makes it, they don't have any solid answer, what is architecture? And to that point, what do you think is a good architecture? So what is architecture? Is a bit hard. I'm not going into that.
No, I can try.
What is
a good one?
I think every When you start as a student, you learn these different definitions of architecture from your teachers, professors. You begin working in different offices. You see, again, different definition, and with that, a different approach to producing architecture from different employers and people you work with. And I think for everyone, I hope, their definition of architecture evolves, grows and evolves with them. I think for me, a good architecture, I see architecture not just as the art of building or the idea of creating spaces or objects or forms. For me, architecture is a framework that organizes the patterns of relations between objects, bodies, and particles in space. I mean, that's what in computer science, they have architecture too, and that's essentially what architecture is. It's obviously not just building. It's not just the practice or the culture and the knowledge and the expertise around it. It includes all of it, but ultimately it's the thing by which those relationships between humans, you know, non-humans, yes, environment is organized and defined. And that's really why, for me, I'm more excited about simulations and how AI can use maybe that knowledge and that level of intelligence. And I'm more interested about, rather than making intelligently designed spaces, I'm actually more interested in making the space itself and the elements in the space give them intelligence, right? So that our chairs and walls and doors have intelligence and they can interact with us, communicate with us. To me, that's more exciting. That's where I see the future of architecture, rather than just using all that computer and brain power to generate more intelligent, static, fixed structures. It's exciting, but less exciting. I think we're moving towards a time where we expect things to talk to us, to interact, yes, with us. Exactly. I mean, at the moment I now say Siri, multiple objects in the room will now listen and respond, right? So we need that interaction. We need buildings to be more adaptive, respond to their environment. We need buildings to be more resilient. We're going through climate change. We're going through a lot of things, changes. And I think it requires us to kind of, rather than just putting the work and using computation and artificial intelligence to improve the design process and end up with a similar product, now invest in making that product more and more intelligent and integrate the technology more into the mundane little things around us, the doors, the windows, the office chairs.
Exactly.
You know, and that's what I'm more excited about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, nice. I love it. So I think we can continue talking for hours. And I know you have lecture after this, but moving forward with my last two questions, what do you think about our platform?
I'm very excited about your platform. I think I mentioned it to you last time, we just spoke yesterday, because I think it's dealing with, you know, in the past, I mean, I don't want to do a long history, but knowledge and information was always a kind of in a privileged space, in a sacred, private, privileged space. And throughout history, we've gone through all these time periods where, you know, knowledge, information, news, you know, all of these things became more and more public. And we realized that they're public rights, right? So universities and education becoming a model as a form of a public institution is obviously embodies that, right? But now I think we're living in a world where we're much more connected. We also have tools that can connect us across multiple boundaries, borders, time zones. We have, you know, we have opportunities we didn't have before. And these opportunities are not just opportunities about sort of the type of things cultural institutions do, like events and lectures and exhibitions and all that, but also things that deal with education itself. So the reason I'm excited about what you've started and are growing is that it's dealing with that, it's using our technology today and, you know, the social media, internet, and webinars and Zooms and all of this to not only just to connect us more, but to actually share that knowledge and information, which was previously only available in very specific places. You had to go, you know, even as students, just not so long ago, like we would hear about a lecture, and if we were lucky, and sometimes we would take a train. I remember a few times I took a train from New York to New Haven because there was a lecture or event at Yale and I wanted to see it, you know. And if I was living in California, I wouldn't be able to go because then I couldn't afford to fly, or I didn't have the time to fly, right? So you were very limited to the things that happened around you, you know, or you had to, if you wanted to hear, learn from certain people, you had to get into that school because they were teaching there and you had to pay a ton of money, tuition, you had to, right? So you had to pick and choose based on the options you had. And I think it's a different model to think about, you know, providing that information and that knowledge and expertise in an online platform where everybody can access anywhere. And in some ways, to me, it decentralizes the educational models we have today. But also, I think the other aspect to that is the type of learning that happens. I think what you guys are doing with the workshops is important because there's a big gap in the academy, in academia, about teaching new tools, teaching ways of using it, new techniques, bringing expertise from different people who are using them, and providing especially a way for both students and practitioners to apply that knowledge in the design, fabrication, and the building industry. I think that's something that inevitably educational institutions will not be as, you know, flexible, responsive, just because the pace of things, how it moves. And there's always gonna be a gap unless there are places where people can learn from others and share that information and exchange knowledge. So, yeah.
Thank you so much. Obviously, in the past couple of years, we've been trying to close that gap, as you mentioned, with the number of workshops and online webinars that we've been doing. And we've been getting so many good feedbacks on doing these workshops. And it's not just students in the universities. It's also people from practice who've been doing this work for 30 years, 20 years. They're joining the workshops to upgrade their knowledge and catch up with the new tools and technologies that are emerging with our profession, which gives them a huge opportunity to move forward with their career. Thank you so much on that. One final question that I'm interested to ask, what is your advice for aspiring architects?
Difficult question. I think we could talk for 2 hours just about that. I think my advice is, and this is, I think, what I tell my students. As architects, we design and tell people how to live in the world, right? Essentially, we script that, right? That this is how, you know, this is where you sleep, this is where you cook. cook, this is where you eat, this is where you work, this is how to use stuff, right? And in order to tell, in order to think what's the best way of interacting and living and experiencing the world, you can only do it well if you have experienced enough. So my best advice is for people, for architects, to travel a lot, do different things, experience, have crazy experiences, be able to actually kind of see what one can do in space, in the world, and to enrich your experience so that when you actually go and want to propose or design new spaces, you have a lot of the experiences that you have had that you could build up, build from, and to then to hopefully come up with new types of experiences, a new type of relationships between people, between peoples and people and their environments, between people and buildings. So a lot of the times, if we just limit ourselves to what architecture has been, what buildings and built environment has been, that's very limiting. And I think we should always look outside of architecture for inspirations, for to learn from how other things work, other spaces function, and to also use our own personal experiences and how we learn how we interact in the world to bring it to the table. So, yeah.
Thank you so much, Iman. This was really a brilliant conversation and I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for coming to our show.
Thank you, Hamid. It was a pleasure. Enjoyed it. Yeah.